stamp of running feet answered my call, and Jamie burst into the room in a heartbeat. Seeing me dragged off my feet by Christie's weight, he seized the man by the scruff of the neck and shoved him forward like a rag doll, pushing Christie's head down between his legs.
"Is he desperate bad?"
Jamie asked, squinting at Christie's injured hand, which was resting on the floor, oozing blood.
"Shall I lay him on the table?"
"I don't think so." I had a hand under Christie's jaw, feeling for his pulse. "He's not hurt badly. He's only fainted. Yes, see? He's coming round. Keep your head down for a bit now. You'll be quite all right in a moment." I addressed this latter remark to Christie, who was breathing like a steam engine, but had steadied a little. Jamie removed his hand from Christie's neck and wiped it on his kilt with an expression of mild distaste. Christie had broken out in a profuse cold sweat. I could feel my own hand slimy with it, but picked up the fallen cloth and wiped my hand more tactfully with that. "Would you like to lie down?" I asked, bending to look at Christie's face. He was still a ghastly colour, but shook his head.
"No, mistress.
I'm quite all right. Only taken queer for a moment." He spoke hoarsely, but firmly enough, so I contented myself with pressing the cloth hard against the wound to staunch the dripping blood. Jamie was loitering in the doorway, wide-eyed, but showing no particular alarm. Blood was nothing new to him.
"Shall I fetch ye a dram, Tom?" Jamie said, eyeing the patient warily. "I ken ye dinna hold with strong drink, but there's a time for it, surely."
Christie's mouth worked a little, but he shook his head.
No. Perhaps a little wine." "Take a little wine for thy stomach's sake, eh? Aye, fine. Take heart, man. I'll fetch it."
Jamie clapped him encouragingly on the shoulder and went briskly off, taking Jemmy by the hand as he went out. Christie's mouth tightened in a grimace. I had noticed before that, like some Protestants, Tom Christie regarded the Bible as being a document addressed specifically to himself and confided to his personal care for prudent distribution to the masses. Thus, he quite disliked hearing Catholics, for example, Jamie, quoting casually from it. I had also noticed that Jamie was aware of this and took every opportunity to make such quotes. "What happened?" I asked, as much to distract Christie as because I wished to know. Christie broke off his glower at the empty doorway and glanced at his left hand, then hastily away, going pale again.
"An accident," he said gruffly. "I was cutting rushes. The knife slipped."
His right hand flexed slightly as he said this, and I glanced at it. "No bloody wonder," I said. "Here, keep that up in the air." I lifted the injured left hand, tightly wrapped above his head, let go of it, and reached for the other. He had been suffering from a condition in the right hand called Dupuytren's contracture. Or at least it would be called that, once Baron Dupuytren got round to describing it in another 60 or 70 years. Caused by a thickening and shortening of the fibrous sheet that kept the hand's tendons in place when the fingers flexed, the result of it was to draw the ring finger in toward the palm of the hand. In advanced cases, the little finger, and sometimes the middle finger as well, were involved. Tom Christie's case had advanced quite a bit since I had last had the chance of a good look at his hand. "Did I tell you?" I demanded rhetorically, pulling gently on the clawed fingers. The middle finger could still be halfway unfolded. The ring and little fingers could barely be lifted away from the palm. "I said it would get worse. No wonder the knife slipped. I'm surprised you could even hold it." A slight flush appeared under the clipped salt and pepper beard, and he glanced away. "I could have taken care of it easily months ago," I said, turning the hand to look critically at the angle of contracture. "It would have been a very simple matter. Now it will be rather more complicated, but I can still correct it, I think." Had he been a less stolid man, I should have described him as wriggling with embarrassment. As it was, he merely twitched slightly, the flush deepening over his face.
I do not desire.
I don't bloody care what you desire, I told him, putting the clawed hand back in his lap. If you don't allow me to operate on that hand, it will be all but useless inside 6 months. You can barely write with it now. Am I right?
His eyes met mine, deep grey and startled.
I can write, he said.
But I could tell that the belligerence in his voice hid a deep uneasiness. Tom Christie was an educated man, a scholar, and the Ridges' schoolteacher. It was to him that many of the Ridge people went for help in the composition of letters or legal documents. He took great pride in this. I knew the threat of loss of this ability was the best lever I had, and it was no idle threat.
Not for long, I said, and widened my eyes at him to make my meaning clear.
He swallowed uneasily, but before he could reply, Jamie reappeared, holding a jug of wine.
"Best listen to her,"
he advised Christie, setting it on the counter.
"I ken what it's like to try to write wi' a stiff finger, I."
He held up his own right hand and flexed it, looking rueful.
"If she could mend that wi' her wee knife, I'd lay my hand on the block this instant."
Jamie's problem was almost the reverse of Christie's, though the effect was quite similar. The ring finger had been smashed so badly that the joints had frozen. It couldn't be bent. Consequently, the two fingers on either side had limited motion as well, though the joint capsules were intact. "The difference being that your hand isn't getting any worse," I told Jamie. "His is." Christie made a small movement, pushing his right hand down between his thighs, as though to hide it.
"Aye. Well,"
he said uncomfortably,
"it can bide a while, surely." "At least long enough to let my wife mend the other," Jamie observed, pouring out a cup of wine. "Here. Can you hold it, Tom? Or shall I?"
He made a questioning gesture, holding the cup as though to feed it to Christie, who snatched his right hand out of the sheltering folds of his clothes.
"I'll manage," he snapped,
and took the wine, holding the cup between thumb and forefinger with an awkwardness that made him flush even more deeply. His left hand still hung in the air above his shoulder. He looked foolish, and obviously felt it. Jamie poured another cup and handed it to me, ignoring Christie. I would have thought it natural tact on his part, were I not aware of the complicated history between the two men. There was always a small barbed edge in any dealings between Jamie and Tom Christie, though they managed to keep an outwardly cordial face on things. With any other man, Jamie's display of his own injured hand would have been just what it seemed, reassurance, and the offering of fellowship in infirmity. With Tom Christie, it might have been consciously meant as reassurance, but there was a threat implied as well, though perhaps Jamie couldn't help that. The simple fact was that people came to Jamie for help more often than they did to Christie. Jamie had widespread respect and admiration, despite his crippled hand. Christie was not a personally popular man. He might well lose what social position he had if he lost his ability to write. And, as I had bluntly noted, Jamie's hand wouldn't get worse. Christie's eyes had narrowed a little over his cup. He hadn't missed the threat, whether intended or not. He wouldn't. Tom Christie was a suspicious man by nature, and inclined to see threat where it wasn't intended. "I think that's settled a bit by now. Let me take care of it." I took hold of his left hand, gently, and unwrapped it. The bleeding had stopped. I set the hand to soak in a bowl of water boiled with garlic, added a few drops of pure ethanol for additional disinfection, and set about gathering my kit. It was beginning to grow dark, and I lit the alcohol lamp Brianna had made for me. By its bright, steady flame, I could see that Christie's face had lost its momentary flush of anger. He wasn't as pale as he had been, but looked as uneasy as a vole at a convention of badgers, his eyes following my hands as I laid out my sutures, needles, and scissors, all clean and gleaming sharp in the light. Jamie didn't leave, but stayed leaning against the counter, sipping his own cup of wine, presumably in case Christy passed out again. A fine trembling ran through Christy's hand and arm, braced as they were on the table. He was sweating again. I could smell it, acrid and bitter. It was the scent of that, half forgotten but immediately familiar, that finally made me realise the difficulty. It was fear. He was afraid of blood, perhaps. Afraid of pain, certainly. I kept my eyes fixed on my work, bending my head lower to keep him from seeing anything in my face. I should have seen it sooner. I would have, I thought, had he not been a man. His paleness, the fainting, not due to loss of blood, but to shock at seeing blood lost. I stitched up men and boys routinely. Mountain farming was rough work, and it was a rare week when I wasn't presented with axe wounds, hoe gouges, spud slashes, hog bites, scalp lacerations sustained while falling over something, or some other minor calamity requiring stitches. By and large, all my patients behaved with complete matter-of-factness, accepting my ministrations stoically and going right back to work. But nearly all of the men were Highlanders, I realised, and many not only Highlanders, but erstwhile soldiers. Tom Christie was a townsman from Edinburgh. He had been imprisoned in Ardsmuir as a Jacobite supporter, but had never been a fighting man. He had been a commissary officer. In fact, I realised with surprise, he had likely never even seen a real military battle, let alone engaged in the daily physical conflict with nature that Highland farming entailed. I became aware of Jamie, still standing in the shadows, sipping wine, and watching with a faintly ironic dispassion. I glanced up quickly at him. His expression didn't alter, though he met my eyes and nodded very slightly. Tom Christie's lip was fixed between his teeth. I could hear the faint whistle of his breath. He couldn't see Jamie, but knew he was there. The stiffness of his back said as much. He might be afraid, Tom Christie, but he had some courage to him. It would have hurt him less could he have relaxed the clenched muscles of arm and hand. Under the circumstances, though, I could hardly suggest as much. I could have insisted that Jamie leave, but I was nearly finished. With a sigh of mingled exasperation and puzzlement, I clipped the final knot and laid down the scissors. "All right, then," I said, swiping the last of the coneflower ointment across the wound and reaching for a clean linen bandage. "Keep it clean. I'll make up some fresh ointment for you. Send Mulver for it. Then come back in a week and I'll take the stitches out." I hesitated, glancing at Jamie. I felt some reluctance to use his presence as blackmail, but it was for Christie's own good. "I'll take care of your right hand, then, too, shall I?" I said firmly. He was still sweating, though the colour in his face had begun to come back. He glanced at me, and then, involuntarily, at Jamie. Jamie smiled faintly.
"Go on, then, Tom," he said. "It's not to trouble you. No, but a wee nick. I've had worse."
The words were spoken casually, but they might as well have been written in flaming letters a foot high. "I've had worse." Jamie's face was still in shadow, but his eyes were clearly visible, slanted with his smile. Tom Christie hadn't relaxed his rigid posture. He matched Jamie's stare, closing his gnarled right hand over the bandaged left.
"Aye," he said. "Well."
He was breathing deeply.
"I will, then."
He rose abruptly, knocking the stool aside, and headed for the door, a little off balance, like a man the worse for strong drink. At the door he paused, fumbling for the knob. Finding it, he drew himself up and turned back, looking for Jamie.
"At least," he said, breathing so hard that he stumbled over the words. "At least it will be an honourable scar, won't it, MacDo?"
Jamie straightened up abruptly, but Christie was already out, stamping down the corridor with a step heavy enough to rattle the pewter plates on the kitchen shelf.
"Why, you wee peasant," he said, in a tone somewhere between anger and astonishment.
His left hand clenched involuntarily into a fist, and I thought it a good thing that Christie had made such a rapid exit. I was rather unsure as to exactly what had happened, or been happening, but relieved that Christie was gone. I'd felt like a handful of grain trapped between two grindstones, both of them trying to grind each other's faces, with no heed for the hapless corn in between.
"I've never heard Tom Christie call you McDo," I observed cautiously, turning to tidy away my surgical leavings. Christie was not, of course, a Gaelic speaker, but I'd never heard him use even the Gaelic nickname that the other Ardsmuir men still called Jamie by. Christie always called Jamie Mr. Fraser, or simply Fraser, in moments of what passed for cordiality. Jamie made a derisive Scottish noise, then picked up Christie's half-full cup and thriftily drained it.
"No, he wouldna, friggin' Sassenach."
Then he caught a glimpse of my face and gave me a lopsided smile.
"I didn't mean you, Sassenach."
I knew he didn't mean me. The word was spoken with a completely different and quite shocking intonation, a bitterness that reminded me that Sassenach was by no means a friendly term in normal usage.
"Why did you call him that?" I asked curiously. "And just what did he mean by that honourable scar crack?"
He looked down and didn't answer for a moment, though the stiffened fingers of his right hand drummed soundlessly against his thigh.
"Tom Christie's a solid man," he said at last. "But by God, he is a stiff-necked wee son of a bitch."
He looked up then and smiled at me a little ruefully.
"8 years he lived in a cell with 40 men who had the Gaelic, and he wouldna lower himself to let a word of such a barbarous tongue pass his lips. Christ, no! He'd speak in English, no matter who it was he spoke to. And if it was a man who had no English, why then he'd just stand there, dumb as a stone, till someone came along to interpret for him."
"Someone like you?"
"Now and then."
He glanced toward the window as though to catch a glimpse of Christie, but the night had come down altogether, and the panes gave back only a dim reflection of the surgery, our own forms ghost-like in the glass.
"Roger did say that Kenny Lindsay mentioned something about Mr. Christie's pretensions," I said delicately.
Jamie shot me a sharp glance at that.
"Oh, he did he? So Roger Mack had second thoughts about his wisdom in taking on Christie as a tenant, I suppose. Kenny wouldn't have said that unless he was asked."
I had more or less got used to the speed of his deductions and the accuracy of his insights and didn't question this one.
"You never told me about that," I said, coming to stand in front of him. I put my hands on his chest, looking up into his face.
He put his own hands over mine and sighed, deep enough for me to feel the movement of his chest. Then he wrapped his arms around me and drew me close, so my face rested against the warm fabric of his shirt.
"Aye, well, that wasn't really important, Ken."
"And you didn't want to think about Ardsmuir, perhaps?"
"No,"
he said softly.
"I have had enough of the past."
My hands were on his back now, and I realized suddenly what Christie had likely meant. I could feel the lines of the scars through the linen, clear to my fingertips as the lines of a fishnet laid across his skin.
"Honourable scars," I said, lifting my head. "Why, that little bastard! Is that what he meant?"
Jamie smiled a little at my indignation.
"Aye, he did," he said dryly. "That's why he called me McDo, to remind me of Ardsmuir, so I'd ken for sure what he meant by it. He saw me flogged there."
That!
I was so angry I could barely speak.
"I wish I'd stitched his fucking hand to his balls."
"And you, a physician, sworn to do nae harm? I'm very much shocked, Sassenach."
He was laughing now, but I wasn't amused at all.
"Beastly little coward. He's afraid of blood, did you know that?"
"Well, I did. You can't live in a man's Oxford for 3 years without learning a great many things you dinna want to know about him, let alone something like that."
He sobered a bit,
though a hint of wryness still lurked at the corner of his mouth. When they brought me back from being whipped, he went white as suet, went and puked in the corner, then lay down with his face to the wall. I wasn't really taking notice, but I remember thinking that was a bit raw. I was the one was a bloody mess. Why was he taking on like a lass with the vapours?
I snorted. Don't you go making jokes about it. How dare he? And what does he mean, anyway? I know what happened at Ardsmuir, and those bloody, well, I mean, those certainly are honourable scars, and everyone there knew it.
Aye, maybe, he said, all hint of laughter disappearing. That time. But everyone could see when they stood me up that I'd been flogged before, aye? And no man there has ever said a word to me about those scars. Not till now.
That brought me up short. Flogging wasn't merely brutal. It was shameful, meant to permanently disfigure as well as to hurt, advertising a criminal's past as clearly as a branded cheek or cropped ear. And Jamie would, of course, prefer to have his tongue torn out by the roots sooner than reveal to anyone the reasons for his scars, even if that meant leaving everyone with the assumption that he'd been flogged for some disgraceful act. I was so used to Jamie's always keeping his shirt on in anyone else's presence that it had never occurred to me that of course the Ardsmuir men would know about the scars on his back. And yet he hid them, and everyone pretended they didn't exist, save Tom Christie.
"Hmm," I said. "Well, goddamn the man anyway. Why should he say such a thing?"
Jamie uttered a short laugh.
"Because he didn't like me watching him sweat. He wanted a bit of his own back, I expect."
"Hmph," I said again, and folded my arms beneath my bosom. "Since you mention it, why did you do that? If you knew he couldn't stand blood and the like, I mean, why stay and watch him like that?"
"Because I kent he wouldn't whimper or faint if I did," he replied. "He'd let you thrust red-hot needles through his eyeballs before he'd squeal in front of me."
"Oh, so you noticed that?"
"Well, of course I did, Sassenach. What do you think I was there for? Not that I didn't appreciate your skill, but watching you stitch up wounds isn't really good for the digestion."
He cast a brief glance at the discarded cloth, splotched with blood, and grimaced.
"Do you think the coffee's gone cold by now?"
"I'll heat it up." I slid the clean scissors back into their sheath, then sterilized the needle I'd used, ran a fresh silk suture through it, and coiled it up in its jar of alcohol, still trying to make sense of things. I put everything back into the cupboard, then turned to Jamie. "You aren't afraid of Tom Christie, are you?" I demanded. He blinked, astonished, then laughed.
"Christ, no! What makes you think that, Sassenach?"
"Well, the way the two of you act sometimes, it's like wild sheep butting heads to see who's stronger."
"All that."
He waved a hand, dismissive.
"I've a harder head by far than Tom, and he kens it well enough. But he's no going to give in and follow me round like a yearling lamb, either."
"Oh? But what do you think you're doing, then?
You weren't just torturing him to prove you could, were you?"
"No," he said, and smiled faintly at me.
"A man stubborn enough to speak English to Hielan men in prison for 8 years is a man stubborn enough to fight beside me for the next 8 years. That's what I think. It would be good if he were sure of it himself, though."
I drew a deep breath and sighed, shaking my head. "I do not understand men." That made him chuckle, deep in his chest.
"Yes, you do, Sassenach. You only wish you didn't."
The surgery lay neat again, ready for whatever emergencies the morrow might bring. Jamie reached for the lamp, but I laid a hand on his arm, stopping him. "You promised me honesty," I said. "But are you quite sure you're being honest with yourself? You weren't baiting Tom Christie just because he challenges you." He stopped, his eyes clear and unguarded a few inches from mine. He lifted a hand and cupped the side of my face, his palm warm on my skin.
There are only two people in this world to whom I would never lie, Sassenach, he said softly. You're one of them, and I'm the other.
He kissed me gently on the forehead, then leaned past me and blew out the lamp.
Mind, his voice came from the darkness, and I saw his tall form silhouetted against the faint oblong of light from the doorway as he straightened up. I could be fooled, but I wouldn't be doing it on purpose.
Roger moved a little and groaned.
I think you broke my leg.
Did not, said his wife, calmer now but still disposed to argument. But I'll kiss it for you if you want.
That'd be nice.
Tremendous rustlings of the corn-shuck mattress ensued as she clambered into position to execute this treatment, ending with a naked Brianna straddling his chest and leaving him with a view that caused him to wish they'd taken time to light the candle. She was, in fact, kissing his shins, which tickled. Given the circumstances, though, he was inclined to put up with it. He reached up with both hands. Lacking light, Braille would do.
When I was 14 or so, he said dreamily, one of the shops in Inverness had a most daring window display. Daring for the times, that is. A lady mannequin wearing nothing but underwear.
Hmm?
Aye. A full-length pink girdle, garters, the lot, with matching brassiere. Everyone was shocked. Committees were got up to protest, and calls were made to all the ministers in town. Next day they took it down, but meanwhile the entire male population of Inverness had been past that window, taking pains to look casual about it. Till this minute, I'd always thought that was the most erotic thing I'd ever seen.
She suspended her operations for a moment, and he thought from the sense of movement that she was looking back over her shoulder at him.
Roger, she said thoughtfully,
I do believe you're a pervert.
Yes, but one with really good night vision.
That made her laugh, the thing he'd been striving for since he'd finally got her to stop frothing at the mouth. And he raised himself briefly, planting a light kiss on either side of the looming object of his affections before sinking contentedly back onto the pillow. She kissed his knee, then put her head down, cheek against his thigh, so the mass of her hair spilled over his legs, cool and soft as a cloud of silk threads. "I'm sorry," she said softly, after a moment. He made a dismissive noise and ran a soothing hand over the round of her hip.
"Och, it's no matter. Too bad, though. I wanted to see their faces when they saw what you'd done."
She snorted briefly, and his leg twitched at the warmth of her breath.
"Their faces were something to see, anyway."
She sounded a little bleak.
"And it would have been a real anticlimax after that." "Well, you're right about that," he admitted. "But you'll show them tomorrow when they're in a frame of mind to appreciate it properly."
She sighed and kissed his knee again.
"I didn't mean it," she said after a moment, implying it was your fault. "Aye, you did," he said softly, still caressing. "That's all right. You're probably right."
Likely she was. He wasn't going to pretend that it hadn't hurt to hear it. But he wouldn't let himself be angry. That would help neither of them.
You don't know that.
She raised up suddenly, looming like an obelisk in silhouette against the pale rectangle of the window. Swinging one leg neatly over his supine body, she slithered down beside him.
It could be me, or neither of us. Maybe it just isn't the right time yet.
He put an arm around her and hugged her close in answer.
Whatever the cause, we'll not blame each other, aye?
She made a small sound of assent and nestled closer.
Well enough. There was no way to keep from blaming himself, though.
The facts were clear enough. She'd got pregnant with Jemmy after one night, whether with himself or Stephen Bonnet, no one knew. But once was all it took. Whereas they'd been trying for the last several months, and Jem was looking more and more like being an only child. Possibly he did lack the vital spark, as Mrs. Bug and her chums speculated.
"Who's your daddy?"
echoed mockingly in the back of his mind. in an Irish accent.
He coughed explosively and settled back, determined not to dwell on that little matter.
"Well, I'm sorry, too," he said, changing the subject. "You may be right about me acting like I'd rather you cook and clean than mess about with your wee chemistry set."
"Only because you would," she said, without rancour. "It's not so much the not cooking as it is the setting things on fire, I mind." "Well, you'll love the next project, then," she said, nuzzling his shoulder. "It's mostly water."
"Oh,
good," he said, though even he could hear the dubious note in his voice.
"Mostly.
There's some dirt involved, too."
"Nothing that burns?"
"Just wood. A little. Nothing special."
She was running her fingers slowly down his chest. He caught her hand and kissed her fingertips. They were smooth but hard, calloused from the constant spinning she did to help keep them clothed.
"Who can find a virtuous woman," he quoted, "for her price is far above rubies. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple."
"I would love to find some dye plant that gives a true purple," she said wistfully. "I miss the bright colours. Remember the dress I wore to the Man on the Moon party? The black one, with the bands of day-glow pink and lime green?
That was pretty memorable, aye."
Privately, he thought the muted colours of homespun suited her much better. In skirts of rust and brown, jackets of grey and green, she looked like some exotic, lovely lichen. Seized by the sudden desire to see her, he reached out, fumbling on the table by the bed. The little box was where she'd thrown it when they came back. She'd designed it to be used in the dark, after all. A turn of the lid dispensed one of the small, waxy sticks, and the tiny strip of roughened metal glued to the side was cooled to his hand. A scritch that made his heart leap with its simple familiarity, and the tiny flame appeared with a whiff of sulphur. Magic.
"Don't waste them," she said, but smiled in spite of the protest, delighted at the sight as she had been when she first showed him what she'd done. Her hair was loose and clean, just washed, shimmering over the pale round of her shoulder, clouds of it lying soft over his chest, cinnamon and amber and roan and gold, sparked by the flame.
"She does not fear the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet,"
he said softly, his free hand round her, twining a lock near her face round his finger, twisting the tiny strand as he'd seen her spin yarn. The long lids of her eyes closed halfway, like a basking cat's, but the smile remained on that wide, soft mouth, those lips that hurt, then healed. The light glowed in her skin, bronzed the tiny brown mole beneath her right ear. He could have watched her forever, but the match was burning low. Just before the flame touched his fingers, she leaned forward and blew it out. And in the smoke-wisped dark, whispered in his ear, "The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life." So there.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
Chapter 22. Ensorcelment. Tom Christie didn't come back to the surgery, but he did send his daughter, Malva, to get the ointment. The girl was dark-haired, slender and quiet, but seemed intelligent. She paid close attention as I quizzed her on the look of the wound. So far, so good. A bit of redness, but no suppuration, no reddish streaks up the arm, and gave her instructions on how to apply the ointment and change the dressing. "Good, then," I said, giving her the jar. "If he should begin a fever, come and fetch me. Otherwise, make him come in a week to have the stitches taken out." Yes, ma'am. I'll do that.
She didn't turn and go, though, but lingered, her gaze flickering over the mounds of drying herbs on the gauze racks and the implements of my surgery.
Do you need something else, dear? Or did you have a question?
She'd seemed to understand my instructions perfectly well, but perhaps she wanted to ask something more personal. After all, she had no mother.
Well, I, she said, and nodded at the table. I only wondered, what is it that you write in yon black book, ma'am?
This? Oh, it's my surgical notes and recipes, receipts, I mean, for medicines. See?
I turned the book round and opened it so that she could see the page where I had drawn a sketch of the damage to Miss Mouse's teeth.
Malva's grey eyes were bright with curiosity, and she leaned forward to read, hands carefully folded behind her back, as though afraid she might touch the book by accident.
"It's all right," I said, a little amused by her caution. "You can look through it if you like."
I pushed it toward her, and she stepped back, startled. She glanced up at me, a look of doubt wrinkling her brow, but when I smiled at her, she took a tiny, excited breath and reached out to turn a page.
"Oh, look!"
The page she'd turned to wasn't one of mine, but one of Daniel Rawlings. It showed the removal of a dead child from the uterus, via the use of assorted tools of dilatation and curettage. I glanced at the page, and hastily away. Rawlings hadn't been an artist, but he had had a brutal knack for rendering the reality of a situation. Malva didn't seem to be distressed by the drawings, though. She was bug-eyed with interest. I began to be interested, too, watching covertly as she turned pages at random. She naturally paid most attention to the drawings, but she paused to read the descriptions and recipes as well.
"Why do you write things down that you've done?" she asked, glancing up with raised eyebrows. "The receipts. Aye. I see you might forget things. But why do you draw these pictures and write down the bits about how you took off a tool with the frost rot? Would you do it differently another time?"
"Well, sometimes you might," I said, laying aside the stalk of dried rosemary I'd been stripping of its needles.
"Surgery isn't the same each time. All bodies are a bit different, and even though you may do the same basic procedure a dozen times, there will be a dozen things that happen differently. Sometimes only tiny things, sometimes big ones. But I keep a record of what I've done for several reasons," I added, pushing back my stool and coming round the table to stand beside her. I turned another few pages, stopping at the record I kept of old Granny Macbeth's complaints, a list so extensive that I'd alphabetized it for my own convenience, starting with arthritis, all joints, running through dyspepsia, earache, and fainting, and then onward for most of two pages, terminating with womb, prolapsed. "Partly so it's that I'll know what's been done for a particular person and what happened, so that if they need treatment later, I can look back and have an accurate description of their earlier state. To compare, you see?" She nodded eagerly. "Aye, I see. So you'd know were they getting better or worse. What else, then?"
"Well, the most important reason," I said slowly, seeking the right words, "is so that another doctor, someone who might come later, so that person could read the record and see how I've done this or that. It might show them a way to do something they hadn't done themselves, or a better way."
Her mouth pursed up in interest. "Oh, you mean someone might learn from this?"
She touched a finger to the page delicately. "How to do what it is you do, without apprenticing himself to a doctor."
"Well, it's best if you have someone to teach you," I said, amused at her eagerness. "And there are things you can't really learn from a book. But if there's no one to learn from..."
I glanced out of the window at the vista of green wilderness swarming over the mountains. "It's better than nothing," I concluded.
"Where did you learn?" she asked, curious. "From this book? I see there's another hand beside yours. Whose was it?"
"I ought to have seen that one coming. I hadn't quite bargained on Malva Christie's quickness, though."
Ah. I learn from a lot of books, I said, and from other doctors.
Other doctors? She echoed, looking at me in fascination. Do you call yourself a doctor, then? I didn't ken women ever could be.
For the rather good reason that no women did call themselves physicians or surgeons now, nor were accepted as such. I coughed.
Well, it's a name, that's all.
A good many people just say wise woman or conjure woman.
Or banlich, I added.
But it's all the same, really. It only matters whether I know something that might help them.
Ban? She mouthed the unfamiliar word. I haven't heard that before.
It's the Gaelic, the Highland tongue, you know. It means female healer or something like.
Oh, the Gaelic.
An expression of mild derision crossed her face. I expected she had absorbed her father's attitude toward the Highlander's ancient language. She evidently saw something in my face, though, for she instantly erased the disdain from her own features and bent over the book again.
Who was it wrote these other bits, then?
A man named Daniel Rawlings. I smoothed the creased page with the usual sense of affection for my predecessor. He was a doctor from Virginia.
Him?
She looked up, surprised.
The same who was buried in the boneyard up the mountain?
Yes. That's him. And the story of how he came to be there was not something to be shared with Miss Christie. I glanced out of the window, estimating the light. Will your father be wanting his dinner?
Oh!
She stood up straight at that, glancing out the window too with a faint look of alarm.
Aye, he will.
She cast a last look of longing toward the book, but then brushed down her skirt and set her cap straight, ready to go.
I thank you, Mrs. Fraser, for showing me your wee book.
Happy to, I assured her sincerely. You're welcome to come again and look at it. In fact, would you... I hesitated, but plunged on, encouraged by her look of bright interest. I'm going to take a growth from Granny Macbeth's ear tomorrow. Would you like to come along with me to see how? It would be a help to me to have another pair of hands, I added, seeing sudden doubt war with the interest in her eyes.
Oh, aye, Mrs. Fraser. I dearly like it, she said. It's only my father.
She looked uneasy as she said it, but then seemed to make up her mind.
Well, I'll come. I'm sure I can talk him round.
Would it help if I were to send a note? Or come and speak with him? I was suddenly quite desirous that she should come with me. She gave a small shake of the head.
Nay, ma'am, it'll be all right, I'm sure.
She dimpled at me suddenly, grey eyes sparkling.
I'll tell him I've had a keek at your black book, and it's no by way of being spells in it at all, but only receipts for teas and purges. I'll maybe not say about the drawings, though, she added.
Spells? I asked incredulously. Is that what he thought?
Oh, aye,
she assured me.
He warned me not to touch it, for fear of ensorcelment.
Ensorcelment? I murmured, bemused. Well, Thomas Christie was a schoolmaster after all. In fact, he might have been right, I thought. Malva glanced back at the book as I went with her to the door, obvious fascination on her face. Chapter 23 Anesthesia. I closed my eyes, and holding my hand a foot or so in front of my face, wafted it gently toward my nose, like one of the parfumeurs I'd seen in Paris, testing a fragrance. The smell hit me in the face like an ocean wave, and with approximately the same effect. My knees buckled, black lines writhed through my vision, and I ceased to make any distinction between up and down. In what seemed an instant later, I came to, lying on the floor of the surgery with Mrs. Bugs staring down at me in horror.
"Mrs. Clare, are you all right, McGillach? I saw you fall."
"Yes," I croaked, shaking my head gingerly as I got up on one elbow.
Put the cork in.
I gestured clumsily at the large open flask on the table, its cork lying alongside. Don't get your face near it. Face averted and screwed into a grimace of caution, she got the cork and inserted it at arm's length.
Phew! What is yon stuff? She said, stepping back and making faces.
She sneezed explosively into her apron.
I've never smelt anything like that, and Bride Kens have smelt a good many nasty things in this room.
That, my dear Mrs. Bug, is ether. The swimming sensation in my head had almost disappeared, replaced by euphoria.
Ether?
She looked at the distilling apparatus on my counter in fascination, the alcohol bath bubbling gently away in its great glass bubble over a low flame, and the oil of vitriol, later to be known as sulfuric acid, slicking its slow way down the slanted tubing, its malign hot scent lurking below the usual surgery smells of roots and herbs.
Fancy! And what's ether, then?
It puts people asleep, so they won't feel pain when you cut them, I explained, thrilled by my success. And I know exactly who I'm going to use it on first.
Tom Christie, Jamie repeated. Have you told him?
I told Marva. She's going to work on him, soften him up a bit. Jamie snorted briefly at the thought.
You could boil Tom Christie in milk for a fortnight and he'd still be hard as a grindstone. And if you think he'll listen to his wee lass prattle about a magic liquid that will put him to sleep...
No, she isn't going to tell him about the ether. I'll do that, I assured him. She's just going to pester him about his hand, convince him he needs it mended.
Hmm.
Jamie still appeared dubious, though not, it seemed, entirely on Tom Christie's account.
This ether you've made, Sasnach, might you not kill him with it?
I had, in fact, worried considerably about that very possibility. I'd done operations frequently where ether was used, and it was, on the whole, a fairly safe anaesthetic. But homemade ether, administered by hand. And people did die of anaesthetic accidents, even in the most careful settings, with trained anaesthetists and all sorts of resuscitating equipment to hand. And I remembered Rosamund Lindsay, whose accidental death still haunted my dreams now and then. But the possibility of having a reliable anaesthetic, of being able to do surgery without pain. I might, I admitted. I don't think so, but there's always some risk. Worth it, though. Jamie gave me a slightly jaundiced look.
Why? Does Tom think so?
Well, we'll find out. I'll explain it all carefully to him, and if he won't... Well, he won't. But I do hope he does.
The edge of Jamie's mouth curled up, and he shook his head tolerantly.
You're like wee Jim wi' a new toy, Sassenach. Take care the wheels dinna come off.
I might have made some indignant reply to this, but we had come in sight of the Bug's cabin, and Archbug was sitting on his stoop, peacefully smoking a clay pipe. He took this from his mouth, and made to stand up when he saw us, but Jamie motioned him back.
Kiema a howl a hrech.
Arch replied with his customary,
"Hm,"
infused with a tone of cordiality and welcome. A raised white brow in my direction and a twiddle of the pipe stem toward the trail indicated that his wife was at our house, if that's who I was looking for. No, I'm just going into the woods to forage a bit, I said, lifting my empty basket by way of evidence. Mrs. Bug forgot her needlework, though. May I fetch it for her? He nodded, eyes creasing as he smiled round his pipe. He shifted his lean buttocks courteously to allow me to go past him into the cabin. Behind me I heard a "hm?" of invitation, and felt the boards of the stoop shift as Jamie sat down beside Mr. Bug. There were no windows, and I was obliged to stand still for a moment to let my eyes adjust to the dimness. It was a small cabin, though, and it took no more than half a minute before I could make out the contents. Little more than the bed frame, a blanket chest, and a table with two stools. Mrs. Bug's work bag hung from a hook on the far wall, and I crossed to get it. On the porch behind me, I heard the murmur of male conversation,
featuring the quite unusual sound of Mr. Bug's voice. He could and did talk, of course, but Mrs. Bug talked so volubly that when she was present, her spouse's contribution was generally not much more than a smile and an occasional mm-hmm of accord or disagreement.
"Yon Christie," Mr. Bug was saying now in a meditative tone of voice. "D'you find him strange, Achimish?"
"Aye, well, he's a lowlander," Jamie said with an audible shrug.
A humorous mm-hmm from Mr. Bug indicated that this was a perfectly sufficient explanation, and was succeeded by the sucking noises of a pipe being encouraged to draw. I opened the bag to be sure that the knitting was inside. In fact, it was not, and I was obliged to poke round the cabin, squinting in the dimness. Oh, there it was, a dark puddle of something soft in the corner, fallen from the table and knocked aside by someone's foot.
"Is he stranger than he might be, Christie?" I heard Jamie ask, his own tone casual.
I glanced through the door in time to see Archbug nod toward Jamie, though he didn't speak, being engaged in a fierce battle with his pipe. However, he raised his right hand and waggled it, displaying the stumps of his two missing fingers.
"Aye," he said finally, releasing a triumphant puff of white smoke with the word. "He wished to ask me whether it hurt a good deal when this was done."
His face wrinkled up like a paper bag, and he wheezed a little.
"High hilarity for Arch Bug." "Why? What did you tell him then, Arch?" Jamie asked, smiling a little.
Arch sat meditatively on his pipe, now fully cooperative, then pursed his lips and blew a small, perfect ring of smoke.
"I said it didn't hurt a bit, at the time."
He paused, blue eyes twinkling.
"Of course, that may have been because I was laid out cold as a mackerel from the shock of it. When I came round, it stung a bit."
He lifted the hand, looking it over dispassionately, then glanced to the door at me.
"You didn't mean to use an axe on poor old Tom, did you, ma'am? He says you're set to mend his hand next week."
"Probably not. May I see?" I stepped out on the porch, bending to him, and he let me take the hand, obligingly switching his pipe to the left. The index and middle finger had been severed cleanly, right at the knuckle. It was a very old injury, so old that it had lost that shocking look common to recent mutilations, where the mind still sees what should be there and tries vainly for an instant to reconcile reality with expectation. The human body is amazingly plastic, though, and will compensate for missing bits as well as it can. In the case of a maimed hand, the remnant often undergoes a subtle sort of useful deformation to maximize what function remains. I felt along the hand carefully, fascinated. The metacarpals of the severed digits were intact, but the surrounding tissues had shrunk and twisted, withdrawing that part of the hand slightly, so that the remaining two fingers and the thumb could make a better opposition. I'd seen old Arch use that hand with perfect grace, holding a cup to drink or wielding the handle of a spade. The scars over the finger stumps had flattened and paled, forming a smooth, calloused surface. The remaining finger joints were knobbed with arthritis, and the hand, as a whole, was so twisted that it really didn't resemble a hand any more, and yet it wasn't at all repulsive. It felt strong and warm in mine, and in fact was oddly attractive, in the same way that a piece of weathered driftwood is. "It was done with an axe, you said?" I asked, wondering exactly how he had managed to inflict such an injury on himself, given that he was right-handed. A slippage might have gashed an arm or leg, but to take two fingers of the same hand right off like that... Realization dawned, and my grasp tightened involuntarily. "Oh, no."
"Oh, aye," he said,
and exhaled a plume of smoke. I looked up, straight into his bright blue eyes.
"Who did it?"
I asked.
"The Frasers," he said.
He squeezed my hand gently, then withdrew his own and turned it to and fro. He glanced at Jamie.
"Not the Frasers of Lovett," he assured him. "Bobby Fraser of Glenhelm and his nephew. Leslie, his name was.
Oh, well, that's good, Jamie replied, one eyebrow lifted. I shouldn't have liked to hear it was close kin of mine.
Art chuckled almost soundlessly. His eyes still gleamed bright in their webs of wrinkled skin. But there was something in that laugh that made me want suddenly to step back a little.
No, you wouldn't, he agreed. Nor me. But this was maybe the year ye would have been born, Hamish. Or a bit before. And there are no Frasers at Glen Helm now.
The hand itself hadn't troubled me at all, but the imagined vision of how it had got that way was making me a trifle faint. I sat down beside Jamie, not waiting for invitation. Why? I said bluntly. How? He drew on his pipe and blew another ring. It struck the remnants of the first, and both disintegrated in a haze of fragrant smoke. He frowned a little and glanced down at the hand, now resting on his knee.
Oh, well, it was my choice. We were Bowmansea, he explained to me. All the men of my sept, we were brought up to it early. I'd had my first bow at 3 and could strike a grouse through the heart at 40 feet by the time I was 6.
He spoke with an air of simple pride, squinting a little at a small flock of doves that were foraging under the trees nearby, as though estimating how easily he could have bagged one.
"I did hear my father tell of the archers," Jamie said, "at Glen Shields. Many of them grants," he said, "and some Campbells."
He leaned forward, elbows on his knees, interested in the story, but wary.
"Aye, that was us."
Arch puffed industriously, smoke wreathing up round his head.
"We'd crept down through the bracken in the night," he explained to me, "and hid among the rocks above the river at Glen Shields, under the bracken and the rowans. You could have stood a foot away and not seen one of us, so thick as it was." "A bit cramped," he added confidentially to Jamie. "You couldn't have stand up to take a piss, and we'd had our suppers. We a bit of beer before we came up the other side of the mountain. All squatting like women we were, trying like the devil to keep our bowstrings dry in our shirts too, what with the rain coming down and dripping down our necks through the fern. But come the dawn," he went on cheerfully, "and we stood on the signal and let fly. I will say it was a bonny sight, our arrows hailing down from the hills on the poor swords camped there by the river. Aye, your feyther fought there too, Hamish," he added, pointing the stem of his pipe at Jamie. "He was one of those by the river."
A spasm of silent laughter shook him.
"No love lost then," Jamie replied very dryly, "between you and the Frasers."
Old Arch shook his head, not at all discomposed.
"None," he said.
He turned his attention back to me, his manner sobering a little.
"So, when the Frasers would capture a grant alone on their land, it was their habit to give him a choice. He could lose his right eye, or the 12 fingers of his right hand. Either way, he wouldn't draw a bow again against them."
He rubbed the maimed hand slowly to and fro against his thigh, stretching it out as though his phantom fingers reached and yearned for the touch of singing sinew. Then he shook his head, as though dismissing the vision, and curled his hand into a fist. He turned to me.
"You weren't intending to take Christie's fingers straight off, were you, Mrs. Frasier?"
"No," I said, startled. "Of course not. He doesn't think..." Arch shrugged, bushy white brows raised toward his receding hairline.
"Oh, goodness sake, for sure, but he seemed very much disturbed at the thought of being cut."
I said. "I'd have to speak to Tom Christie." Jamie had stood up to take his leave, and I followed suit automatically, shaking out my skirts and trying to shake out of my head the mental image of a young man's hand pinned to the ground and an axe thunking down.
"No Frasers at Glen Helm, you said?" Jamie asked thoughtfully, looking down at Mr. Bug. "Leslie, the nephew. He would have been Bobby Frasier's heir, would he?"
"Aye, he would."
Mr. Bug's pipe had gone out.
He turned it over and knocked the dottle neatly out against the edge of the porch.
Both killed together, were they? I mind my father telling of it once. Found in a stream. Their heads caved in, he said.
Archbog blinked up at him, eyelids lowered, lizard-like, against the sun's glare.
"Well, you see, Hamish," he said, "a bow's like a good wife, eh? Knows her master and answers his touch. An axe, though."
He shook his head.
"An axe is a whore. Any man can use one, and it works as well in either hand."
He blew through the stem of the pipe to clear it of ash, wiped the bowl with his handkerchief, and tucked it carefully away, left-handed. He grinned at us, the remnants of his teeth sharp-edged and yellowed with tobacco.
"Go with God, Seamus MacBrien."
Later in the week, I went to the Christie cabin to take the stitches out of Tom's left hand and explain to him about the ether. His son, Alan, was in the yard, sharpening a knife on a foot-treadled grindstone. He smiled and nodded to me, but didn't speak, unable to be heard above the rasping whine of the grindstone. Perhaps it was that sound, I thought, a moment later, that had aroused Tom Christie's apprehensions.
"I've decided that I shall leave my other hand as it is," he said stiffly, as I clipped the last stitch and pulled it free.
I set down my tweezers and stared at him. "Why?"
A dull red rose in his cheeks, and he stood up, lifting his chin and looking over my shoulder so as not to meet my eye. "I have prayed about it, and I have come to the conclusion that if this infirmity be God's will, then it would be wrong to seek to change it." I suppressed the strong urge to say stuff and nonsense, but with great difficulty. "Sit down," I said, taking a deep breath, "and tell me, if you would, just why you think God wants you to go about with a twisted hand." He did glance at me then, surprised and flustered.
"Why, it is not my place to question the Lord's ways."
"Oh, isn't it?" I said mildly. "I rather thought that's what you were doing last Sunday. Or wasn't it you, I heard, inquiring as to what the Lord thought he was about, letting all these Catholics flourish like the green bay tree?" The dull red colour darkened substantially.
"I'm sure you've misunderstood me, Mistress Fraser."
He straightened himself still further, so that he was nearly leaning over backward.
"The fact remains that I shall not require your assistance."
"Is it because I'm a Catholic?" I asked, settling back on the stool and folding my hands on my knee. "You think perhaps I'll take advantage of you and baptise you into the Church of Rome when you're off your guard?"
"I've been suitably christened," he snapped,
"and I will thank you to keep your popish notions to yourself."
"I have an arrangement with the Pope," I said, giving him stare for stare. "I issue no bulls on points of doctrine, and he doesn't do surgery. Now, about your hand."
"The Lord's will," he began stubbornly.
"Was it the Lord's will that your cow should fall into the gorge and break her leg last month?" I interrupted him. "Because if it was, then you presumably ought to have left her there to die, rather than fetching my husband to help pull her out, and then allowing me to set her leg. How is she, by the way?" I could see the cow in question through the window, peacefully grazing at the edge of the yard, and evidently untroubled either by her nursing calf or by the binding I had applied to support her cracked cannon bone.
"She is well, I thank you."
He was beginning to sound a little strangled, though his shirt was loose at the collar.
"That is..." "Well, then," I said, "do you think the Lord regards you as less deserving of medical help than your cow?" "It seems unlikely to me, what with him regarding sparrows and all that."
He'd gone a sort of dusky purple round the jowls by this point, and clutched the defective hand with the sound one, as though to keep it safe from me.
"I see that you've have heard something of the Bible," he began, very pompous.
"Actually, I've read it for myself," I said. "I read quite well, you know."
He brushed this remark aside, a dim light of triumph gleaming in his eye.
"Indeed."
Then I am sure you will have read the letter of St. Paul to Timothy, in which he says, "Let a woman be silent."
I had, in fact, encountered St. Paul and his opinions before, and had a few of my own.
I expect St. Paul ran into a woman who could out-argue him too, I said, not without sympathy. Easier to try to put a stopper on the entire sex than to win his point fairly.
I should have expected better of you, though, Mr. Christie.
But that's blasphemy, he gasped, clearly shocked.
It is not, I countered, unless you're saying that St. Paul is actually God. And if you are, then I rather think that's blasphemy.
But let's not quibble, I said, seeing his eyes begin to bulge.
Let me... I rose from my stool and took a step forward, bringing me within touching distance of him. He backed up so hastily that he bumped into the table and knocked it askew, sending Mulver's work basket, a pottery jug of milk, and a pewter plate cascading to the floor with a crash. I bent swiftly and grabbed the work basket in time to prevent it being soaked by the flood of milk. Mr. Christie had as swiftly seized a rag from the hearth and bent to mop up the milk. We narrowly missed bumping heads, but did collide, and I lost my balance, falling heavily against him. He caught hold of my arms by reflex, dropping the rag, then hastily let go and recoiled, leaving me swaying on my knees. He was on his knees as well, breathing heavily, but now a safe distance away. "The truth of it is," I said severely, pointing a finger at him, "you're afraid."
"I am not."
"Yes, you are." I got to my feet, replaced the work basket on the table, and shoved the rag delicately over the puddle of milk with my foot. "You're afraid that I'll hurt you." "But I won't," I assured him. "I have a medicine called ether. It will make you go to sleep, and you won't feel anything." He blinked at that. "And perhaps you're afraid that you'll lose a few fingers, or what use of your hand you have." He was still kneeling on the hearth, staring up at me. "I can't absolutely guarantee that you won't," I said. "I don't think that will happen. But man proposes and God disposes, doesn't he?" He nodded very slowly, but didn't say anything. I took a deep breath, for the moment, out of argument. "I think I can mend your hand," I said. "I can't guarantee it. Sometimes things happen. Infections, accidents, something unexpected, but..." I reached out a hand to him, motioning toward the crippled member. Moving like a hypnotized bird trapped in a serpent's gaze, he extended his arm and let me take it. I grasped his wrist and pulled him to his feet. He rose easily and stood before me, letting me hold his hand. I took it in both of mine and pressed the gnarled fingers back, rubbing my thumb gently over the thickened palmar aponeurosis that was trapping the tendons. I could feel it clearly, and could see in my mind exactly how to approach the problem, where to press with the scalpel, how the calloused skin would part, the length and depth of the Z-shaped incision that would free his hand and make it useful once more. "I've done it before," I said softly, pressing to feel the submerged bones. "I can do it again, God willing, if you'll let me." He was only a couple of inches taller than I. I held his eyes as well as his hand. They were a clear, sharp grey, and searched my face with something between fear and suspicion, but with something else at the back of them. I became quite suddenly aware of his breathing, slow and steady, and felt the warmth of his breath on my cheek.
"All right," he said at last, hoarsely.
He pulled his hand away from mine, not abruptly, but almost with reluctance, and stood cradling it in his sound one.
"When?"
"Tomorrow," I said. "If the weather is good. I'll need good light," I explained, seeing the startled look in his eyes. "Come in the morning, but don't eat breakfast." I picked up my kit, bobbed an awkward curtsy to him, and left, feeling rather queer. Alan Christie waved cheerfully to me as I left, and went on with his grinding. "Do you think he'll come?" Breakfast had been eaten, and no sign yet of Thomas Christie. After a night of broken sleep in which I dreamed repeatedly of ether masks and surgical disasters, I wasn't sure whether I wanted him to come or not.
Aye, he'll come.
Jamie was reading the North Carolina Gazette, 4 months out of date, while munching the last of Mrs. Bugg's cinnamon toast.
Look, they've printed a letter from the governor to Lord Dartmouth, saying what an unruly lot of seditious, conniving, thieving bastards we all are, and asking General Gage to send him cannon to threaten us back into good behaviour. I wonder if MacDonald knows that's public knowledge.
Did they really? I said absently. I rose and picked up the ether mask I had been staring at all through breakfast. Well, if he does come, I suppose I'd best be ready. I had the ether mask Bree had made for me in the dropping bottle, laid out ready in my surgery, next